This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you've been living in Vermont for a while, you've probably heard this. We have a declining enrollment in our public schools. There are fewer than 80,000 kids in school here. 20 years ago, there were more than 100,000 students. But the number of schools and the number of teachers and staff who educate Vermont children have not dropped at the same pace. Vermont now has the highest per student spending in the nation and a student to staff ratio of 4.7 to 1. Couple those figures with rising property taxes, and many residents, lawmakers, and the governor all say Vermont has a problem. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to talk about that. Both the House and Senate Education Committees are talking through these issues and trying to come up with a plan that will save money and give Vermont children the best possible education. Of course, not everyone agrees on the right way to do that. Should we consolidate schools to save expenses and offer more educational possibilities? Or is there merit in the attention students can get from teachers in a small school and value beyond cost to having schools as the heart of our rural communities? It's a tough call, and as I said, legislators are trying to work it out. We're joined now by the House Education Chair, David Sharp, to talk through some of what his committee is doing and what legislators are trying to achieve. Representative Sharp, welcome to the program, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
There may be more than one issue here. I mean, I sort of laid out a couple of issues and a couple of questions that people have about what makes the best education for children. But I'm hoping that we can sort of address what the issues are, and then we can talk a little bit about how you're thinking you might solve them. So one issue, declining enrollment. But with pretty much the same number of schools, a lot of staff, so the staff-to-student ratio is, you know, there are a lot more staff in Vermont schools than the national ratio. So costs are high, grand lists aren't able to keep up. So are you trying to find a way to reduce the costs of education in Vermont? Is that one of the problems you're trying to solve?
So I would step back just a bit from that and start with saying we have excellent schools in the state of Vermont, but we do have some problems. And the two areas in which we don't do well in our schools is educating kids from low-income families and inspiring more of our students to go on to education beyond high school. We have a very high graduation rate, maybe the highest in the nation, but only 44% of our students aspire to go to school beyond or training of some sort beyond high school. So we have work to do to improve our schools. We have to do that work within a cost structure that taxpayers can afford. And taxpayers have certainly sent out a signal that it's getting pretty expensive. And the statistics are that we do spend a lot per student compared to other states in the country.
Do you think the way Vermont schools are structured now, the number we have, that student-to-staff ratio, if we had all the money in the world, if taxpayers weren't feeling burdened by the cost of education, if you could sort of take money out of the equation, would the way we've structured our education and our number of schools be right?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. If we're trying to design, if we were starting from scratch and we were trying to design a school system to educate roughly 90,000 pupils in the state of Vermont, would we create a system that had over 300 school districts, that had over 1,400 school board members, and had 13 different governance models across the state? It's confusing, it's convoluted, and I don't think it helps control costs or produce good educational opportunities for students.
So the answer is no, you certainly wouldn't design it the same way that it has sort of morphed into.
Right.
Okay, so what would look like a better system?
So the problem is, we've got what we've got. How do we get to something better? And I think that there is widespread belief, particularly among educational professionals, that we need larger integrated pre-K through 12 educational systems, that will allow superintendents and educators to more efficiently deploy educational resources so that kids have better opportunities And it will allow business offices to run more efficiently and save more and save some money.
Okay, so that sort of addresses that district consolidation idea, that if you have less of a bureaucracy or more consolidated bureaucracy, that you're better able to sort of control things over a wider demographic. And you think that will actually also enhance educational opportunities?
So I shy away a bit from the word consolidation because it implies closing something. The only thing I really want to close is supervisory union boards. We have supervisory union budgets in my part of the state that now dwarf the elementary school budgets in the supervisory union, and nobody gets to vote on those. So they're assessed, like a county budget is assessed to the local school district, and it greatly impacts the budget of that community trying to pay for its schools. There's resentment among members in the community. There's that there's this $7.5 million budget that if they vote down the budget in their local school may have to cut a teacher or a sports program or something. But that supervisor union budget assessment stays in place. Forming a school district in place of a supervisory union, then voters are going to be able to vote on the entire budget. There'll be more input pressure by Vermonters to reduce administrative costs and to do things more efficiently within the school district that simply are not accessible to citizens at this point.
We're talking right now with Representative David Sharp. He's the chair of the House Education Committee, and we're talking a little bit about how best to serve Vermont students and how to control the costs of education in Vermont. We have a note from Bruce who says, there's nothing inherently contradictory between consolidating education services and maintaining local control. With readily available technologies, there's no reason the administrative functions of the system can't be handled directly by a central location. When it comes to the educational functions, local districts can direct the approach, hire the staff, and evaluate the proposals of building administrators like principals to define how the children of the district will be educated, to set the goals and the measures of district schools. Listeners, if you want to chime in, if this is something that you're thinking about in your town, in your community, maybe you're a parent and thinking about how you think your own children would be best served, you can add your thoughts to the mix. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your comments online. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. We got a note as well from Chris in Cabot who says, I take exception to the premise that small schools are less able than large schools to provide students with a quality education. From my son's experience, I believe that small schools like Cabot can provide a strong academic foundation for a wide range of students and can also, because of their size, involve a much larger proportion of their students in valuable extracurricular activities. I hope that legislators can look carefully at the educational strengths of both small and large schools before enacting legislation that might lead to the closure of some small but highly successful Vermont schools. All right, so let's look at the premise there, Chris. He says, Dave Sharp, because Chris says he takes exception to the premise that small schools are less able to educate students than large schools. Where do you stand on that? Are small schools failing Vermont children?
That's not my premise. I think there are more and less successful small schools, as there are more and less successful medium schools. We don't have any large schools. We actually have tiny schools, small schools, and medium schools, a couple of medium schools. But I do think that the creation of a larger, more efficient school district in which the small schools reside, number one, in our bill, they get to keep that money that's designated as a small schools grant, as a merger grant, in order to help educate the kids in that school district. I also think that those schools that are doing well will actually be more viable and get better support from a larger school district than they are now, sort of hanging out on their own trying to figure it out. We see a number of small schools being forced to close because the economics just aren't working. If within a larger school district, they were able to consolidate business operations and save some money through business operations, which the Vermont Association of School Business Officials has indicated there's a fair amount of savings there. And they're able to move teaching staff and students around to make schools more efficient and more create more opportunities for students. I think that's a good thing for small schools who are not doing well. It may help them do much better. For small schools that are doing well, it will give them the support they need without dramatic increases in property taxes.
So when you say able to move students and teachers around, I can understand how a teacher within a larger district might be able to teach Chinese at one school and then go teach Chinese at another school. And so you're using one teacher to staff both schools rather than trying to staff a Chinese teacher at one school and another, you know, with separate budgets and separate staffing and separate hiring. When you say moving students around, you think students would also maybe move between and among schools depending on what the offerings are?
Sure. Small schools could become specialized in various aspects of education. You could have a school that focuses more on arts. You could have a different school that focuses more on STEM technology. We also have taken testimony that we have kids on buses right now that drive past one school in order to get to another one. And if you can balance out the capacity of schools to educate students in an effective and efficient way, we can actually do a better job for less money.
Let's go to Howard, who's calling in from Wyndham. Hi, Howard. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to say I really support this idea of getting rid of the middle structure of administration in the Vermont school system. It's crazy. We have 60 $120,000 a year school superintendents. We have 60 financial officers. We spend millions of dollars maintaining these supervisory union offices. If the state would make the commitment to keeping our schools open and streamlining the administration, one payroll system for the state, one superintendent, one financial officer, one bookkeeping system, boy, we would solve our financial problem in a second.
Howard, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Representative Sharp, do you agree with Howard?
So there are proposals to have one school district for the entire state of Vermont, and it would create some efficiencies. There's also great resistance to the state running everything. So this is a intermediate step. Does it have all the efficiencies that one bookkeeping system for the state of Vermont might have? No, it doesn't. But it also keeps the involvement of local people in what they consider their locality. We've heard from Chittenden East, which is in the middle of forming an enlarged school district, that the sense of community is expanding. And one of the things that we really have to realize in this state that the caller just alluded to is that the Constitution requires us to educate all of the children in the state of Vermont. It doesn't say all of the children in your town or my town. It says we're responsible for educating all the students in the state of Vermont. So enlarging our sense of community to be beyond the town borders and include the surrounding communities, maybe 5 or 10 surrounding communities in a single school district, is really a step in the right direction.
Let's go to Harry, who's calling in from Craftsbury. Hi, Harry. Go ahead.
Hi. How's it going?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call. Listen, I just wanted to put in my support for small schools in Vermont. I'm currently on the school board at Craftsbury Academy, where we are, I believe, the smallest school in the state. We've been around since 1829. We have had a 100% graduation rate in the last few years. We also generally send 70 to 80% of our students on to college. Our enrollment's up. Our property taxes are actually dropping this year. And not that test scores mean anything, but we're also we finished first in the state for test scores. And we've dropped our tuition rate. And I think that my point being that I think small schools have a place in Vermont. I listened to Mr. Sharp, and I agree that if there's a district with a smaller school and a larger school, maybe high school, that there's a place for that. I think geography also plays a role. If you we talked about redistricting here for many times, and it's a matter of having kids on the bus for 2 hours each way. So it's, I think geography plays a role. Our supervisor union is the largest geographically in the state, and I think it's a tough issue as well, but I think I need to say that I think small schools are alive and well and that we're doing a great job.
Thanks. Harry, I appreciate your perspective. Thank you very much for sharing that. Representative Sharp, you know, you said earlier you shy away from the word consolidation because it sounds like closing things, and you said you're not in favor of closing schools. Do you think there is a place, though, for some school consolidation in Vermont?
So clearly some schools have already closed. They have not been able to make the economics work. They've not been able to deliver education to their children in an effective manner, and they've had to close their schools. And that's unfortunate that they're forced to close due to economics. Now parents have to figure out a way to where they're going to send their kids, and it may mean that two-hour ride. So choice becomes like sort of a harsh sentence rather than an opportunity. I appreciate that some small schools are doing really well, and we need to have an environment in which they can continue. But in the cases where small schools are struggling, it may be appropriate in places to close them in a much more thoughtful manner within a larger school district where voters still have input on the curriculum and how those schools are run, and parents have better opportunities for their children.
We're talking today with Representative David Sharp. He's the chair of the House Education Committee. His committee is looking at ways to change Vermont's education funding model, to change the way we organize our schools and our school districts. We've been talking with him a little bit about his perspective on what works for small schools. We're going to talk a little bit more about what doesn't. And we'll also be joined by Senator Ann Cummings, who's the chair of the Senate Education Committee. Her committee is also working on these issues. And listeners, if you want to share what's happening in your town or how you think about these issues, what would work best for your kids and for all Vermont kids, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your comments online at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking today with the chairs of Vermont's House and Education Committees, House and Senate Education Committees. We've been hearing from Representative David Sharp, and we're now joined by Senator Ann Cummings, who got tied up in committee earlier. It's a pleasure to have you here, Senator Cummings.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've been talking a little bit about a vision for Vermont schools and what would work. What would work to save money, to cut costs, and also what would work best for Vermont students. Representative Sharp has been sharing his thoughts, and we're hearing from some listeners as well. A lot of people thinking about this in the state of Vermont, certainly parents, taxpayers, and legislators, as we're hearing. If you'd like to share your thoughts about what's happening in your town or how you envision Vermont schools working best, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post thoughts online at vpr.net. If you could envision a system, what would it look like? What works best for taxpayers and for students? Again, go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Let's go right into the calls, and Senator Cummings will weave in your perspective here as we go through what our listeners are asking and saying about. Tom is calling in from Castleton. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I was. I wanted to know how the last representative. I guess he's gone now. But
oh no, he's here. Representative Sharp's still here.
He was making the comments about the SU budgets and how we don't get to vote on them directly. But Act 153 has just moved two major portions of the budget away from the local schools to the SUs. So how do you square those two things?
All right. Thanks for the call. SU supervisory unions here, and we're talking about not just your own school budget, but the budget for the entire supervisory union, which is separate. And Representative Sharp, you were saying it can increase the cost to towns for funding education, but they have less control over it. So what about what Tom's
asking?
That's
right. And one of the areas where the legislature has moved costs into the supervisory union is special ed. I think we recognize that special ed costs are problematic, and that we are hoping that by putting those costs into the supervisory union, that they'll be more efficient and effectively used within that supervisor union. And I think we've seen some evidence that that is happening. When you have a student move into a community, you know, as a surprise at the beginning of the school season, it's not built into that school's annual budget. But the supervisory union can move personnel around to accommodate that. And that's exactly the thinking behind expanded school districts. It's just we need to create a mechanism where the voters have a say in this, as well as creating the efficiencies of the larger governance unit.
Senator Cummings, what's your perspective on that, on increasing the size of school districts and shrinking the number of school districts that we currently have, and about that issue of local control and budget control and efficiency?
The Senate, because we only have afternoons, we're a half-day committee, is still working our way through all of the same issues the House has been working their way through. And I think our main concern is equity in education. We think that we've done equity in funding with Act 60, but small schools, in large part, have a difficult time providing the same access to education and peers and everything else that goes into the development of a whole child than larger schools, just by size. And we could afford to do that for a while, but the numbers right now with declining enrollment say that the pressure we're under is going to continue and is going to get worse. And schools are now starting to cut back into programming, and we're kind of in a downward spiral. So we're trying to find a way to stop that spiral and to start moving us up. And we're dealing, change is difficult. Change when it comes to your children is more difficult. Local schools have been with us probably since before we were a state. They are part of who we are as Vermonters. And that change is going to be a hard one to make. And I think we're trying to figure out, we think we know where we need to go, but we're working to figure out that there doesn't seem to be one size is the answer so far. And we may evolve to think that there is. But at this point, we're trying to figure out a way to keep local involvement and to tell the locals what they need to do and then let them figure out how to do it.
So do you think that district consolidation will provide enough efficiencies that school consolidation won't be necessary, or is it going to take some of both to get the most cost savings and the best education?
I think that varies by district. If you look at some of our districts, you wonder who created them in the first place. There's mountains in the middle. There's roads that don't go from here to there. And there's no two districts are alike. They have different grades, they have choice, they have different high schools. And so to say, okay, this is gonna be it for everyone, at least personally, I'm more comfortable with saying, this is what we need you to accomplish, and you tell us how you're gonna fix that.
All right, and so just before we get to more calls and more listeners who want to share, what is the this is what you need to accomplish that you think you're going to hit? And let me just say as well, you have lovely bracelets on, but they're banging on the table.
Sorry.
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. I think we're looking at things like class size, and is there an optimum class size so that you have enough mixture of students to can support enough teachers.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at course offerings. We're looking at all those things like, hours and transportation and efficiency. We're looking at the ability to provide after-school programs and summer programs, because the numbers on those and the advantages to kids are impressive, especially in closing the learning gap between lower income and higher income students. And we're still, trying to get that down so that it is measurable. But we're looking for something measurable that schools can provide.
Representative Sharp, is that a similar approach in the House? Are you looking at certain measurables that will probably go into your final legislation?
We're looking also at a voluntary approach. There are measurables that we also probably emphasize the role of the State Board of Education more than what I've seen so far in the Senate bill. So our idea is that local school districts should get together, figure out what the best arrangement for a larger pre-K to 12 education district for their region, and put that together and bring it to the State Board of Education and then take it to the voters. That's the way our process is in place at the moment. Now, there's an awful lot. Doing this is very difficult. So there's an awful lot of discussion, both from committee members and legislators and the public who've come in to testify in our committee. We have a voluntary process in place. It's been rarely taken advantage of. There's great resentment if the state just goes out and does one size fits all, as the senator is referring to. So finding a path that's somewhere in between that accomplishes the goal of having better educational outcomes at a price that taxpayers can afford has been our challenge. And where we're at right now is this voluntary process that goes through the State Board of Education.
I see a lot of nodding from Senator Cummings on the idea that this is hard. This is hard work.
This is very hard. And I think we're all trying to find there's a lot of discussions going on. There's been a lot of near misses in consolidations. They seem to get to a certain point, and then they just can't get over that last hump. It's stepping off the cliff. And we're, I think, trying to find, on both bodies, we're trying to find the appropriate balance between carrots and sticks to just help you make that. You just can't get this far and say, no, we just don't feel like it. Because as things are set up now, all the taxpayers in the state are supporting you not feeling like it. And children are arguably not getting the best education that they could be getting in this state.
I want to see if we can get to a couple of those carrots and sticks, but I know we also have a lot of listeners who are thinking about this and want to weigh in. Let's go to Will, who's calling in from Hinesburg. Hi, Will, your thoughts.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. So it's frustrating to me to hear this discussion talk about small schools versus large schools as an either-or situation. We need them both. I was educated in a one-room school in Vermont, and for the first 4 years, it was just awesome. It was a very tight-knit community, and we, being very tender and small, were nurtured, you know, like we should have been. But by the time I moved out of that one-room school and went to a junior high school in the nearby town, I was way behind in terms of science and some of the languages that were available to other schools. So it's not an either-or situation. We need the small schools in our local communities for our small kids. But by sixth grade, at least, they need to be moving on to a bigger school where they can have more put in front of them.
Will, thanks for your comments. I appreciate your perspective, and you're echoing what Representative Sharp said earlier about this isn't just a sense of all small schools must close at all, at least in his opinion, and I'm getting a nod again from Senator Cummings. Let's go to Ronnie in Woodstock before we come back to our guests here. Ronnie, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Between my husband and I, we have over 70 years of teaching in schools between K through 12, and large schools and small schools. And I wondered how much input the senators and the congressmen have gotten from educators. I keep hearing the perspective from taxpayers and saving money, and I went to school in a small school, and it was fine for me, it should be fine for my kids type attitudes, but teachers have a really different view on what's right for kids or not, or what doesn't work for kids, or what does work for kids. And I wondered how much input decisions were being made based on what children need and from the educators who actually have some real experience with this.
Ronnie, thanks for your call. I'll read one comment from an educator before we go to Senator Cummings and Representative Sharp. Cindy wrote in to say, I've worked in elementary education since the 1980s in a small school in Addison County. I saw enrollment increase when we had a positive school board and administration which decided to invest in the school. Real estate began to encourage families to look for housing in this town because of the good school. With the increased clamor about schools being too expensive, the board changed its attitude and began cutting. More importantly, the once supportive community turned against the school. This attitude was picked up by the students, and the atmosphere became less conducive to learning. With more behavioral and mental health problems and the negative effects of poverty, I have seen the school struggle to meet student needs with less money. Class size has gone down, but busing these students to a bigger school will not make a difference. They are in the perfect place to get individual support if we as citizens really put our money where our mouth is. Our youth is our future. We can and we should spend more money to give these children the education they deserve. Okay, so that's one educator's perspective. Ronnie wanted to know, Senator Cummings, are you hearing from educators as you work through this?
We are. All the usual suspects, principals, superintendents, and the Vermont NEA are probably renting space in our committee rooms. They're there daily. We have had several hearings with school personnel, and we are actually having teachers in. I believe teachers, they're having their day at the State House this week, and so we are having teachers in. The one thing that we have heard consistently is that schools and teachers are being asked to deal with problems that they never were in my day or even in my children's day, that poverty is having a major impact on the schools and on children, and that a lot of time and effort and energy and money is going into this. And my committee is especially interested in finding out if we couldn't use some other source of state money, where we have so much this year, but do a closer coordination between, you know, state family services and take some of that off the schools.
You mentioned, Senator Cummings, a moment ago, the carrot and stick approach. And I just want to get a couple of ideas into this conversation that you're discussing in both of your committees about how to do that, how to have incentives, how to encourage district consolidation, and how to maybe, it sounds to me like, give towns a better idea of exactly what the expenses are for their schools. And some of those ideas are to gradually phase out the small schools grant and the phantom student funding. So the phantom student funding is basically that schools get to use a three-year average of their enrollment when it comes to what the funding is that they get per pupil. So if your enrollment is going down, you're actually getting a little bit more money than the number of students you have would entitle you to, because you're using a three-year average, and presumably that average is higher than the number of students you have if your enrollment is declining. And the small schools grant is basically very small schools with enrollment, I think it is under 100 or with class sizes under 20, get a little extra money from the state as well to stay in business. And what I'm hearing is that both of your committees are considering eliminating those grants, phasing them out. So, Representative Sharp, would the money that the state saves be enough to help everybody's property taxes, or is that really just a stick, sort of a sense to schools that, and towns, that this is what it actually costs to run your school? Now you have better numbers. Maybe you want to think about other options.
Right. So first, let me say, small schools that join together or join a larger school district, 1,000 students, integrated pre-K through 12, keep that money. It does not go away. It gets converted into a merger grant. Whether that'll make it to the finish line, I don't know, but that's currently what's in the law.
So that's sort of a carrot and a stick.
And a stick. You do nothing, you know, and try to say, you know, as some people do, is my school is great. It's your school that's the problem. and decline to get involved in forming a larger school district, yeah, they lose their small schools grant. But if you do find a way to find partners and create a larger school district, you get to keep that as a merger grant. The phantom students, by the way, both the small schools grant and the phantom students money strictly reduce the taxes those citizens pay in those communities. And it's understandable to me, if you lose 10 students, that in one single year, that accommodating that in that year's budget is somewhat difficult. So our proposal allows that 3.5% to hold harmless, to stay in place for 1 year. But the way the current system works is that those phantom students can hang on for more than a decade. It does not seem reasonable to me that you should be able to count students that don't exist for a decade just to keep the taxes lower in your community.
Senator Cummings, do you think that with that carrot and stick approach and the approaches that we've talked about so far during the program, that that's enough to really make a significant shift in how much it costs us to educate our children and to make sure that we're doing that to the best of our ability?
The numbers are still out. I think it varies with school districts. I think that selling this on a huge cost savings would be a little ingenuous. Over time, we should save. We should be able to save on administrative costs. We should be able to keep superintendents for more than a year and principals. We have a huge turnover. And we should be able to get some stability and some predictability.
Well, there's certainly more to talk about here. We'll continue to cover this issue on VPR. We've been talking today on Vermont Edition with David Sharp, who's chair of the House Education Committee, and with Ann Cummings, who's chair of the Senate Education Committee. Thank you both for sharing your perspective. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Coming up, a pop-up university is about to hit the streets of Bethel, Vermont. We'll find out how the emotional toll of Tropical Storm Irene led the town of Bethel to find innovative ways for community members to connect. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. You've probably heard of pop-up restaurants, a one-time event that could be anywhere and then disappears as quickly as it arrived. Maybe you've been to a pop-up dance party or been surprised by a pop-up flash mob. But how about a pop-up university? Well, if you're anywhere near Bethel, Vermont in the month of March, you can try it out for yourself. Rebecca Sanborn Stone is one of the original organizers of Bethel University, just about to enter its second year. Rebecca, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So if you peruse the course catalog for Bethel University, you'll find everything from how to structure the beginning of your novel to the history of beer, which is usually more of an extracurricular activity at most colleges. Tick off a couple of the other things that people can learn if they go to Bethel University.
It's quite a range. There's really something for everyone. We have everything from growing a tea garden to dodgeball to how you can go solar. There are craft courses like needle felting animals and making upcycled crafts. There's Zumba. There's basic auto mechanics. We really do have a great range of courses this year.
So this is a one-month event, the Pop-Up University in Bethel. Anyone can be a student and sign up for a course. It's free for students. And anyone can be a teacher and teach something that they have an interest in, that they're passionate about. How does this exactly work?
Yeah, it's really flexible. Our main goal is just creating a forum for people to be able to share what they love and what they know about, and equally creating a forum for people to learn and meet their neighbors. So we have a core group of about 12 organizers who help to facilitate this process. In January, we open up a call for proposals, and literally anyone in Bethel or beyond can propose a course. I think this year our professors come from about 7 different towns in the state. And after they propose, we go through, we match professors to dates and times and locations, and then we open up registration. And again, anyone from Bethel or beyond can take a class.
And so in some of the classes, you might meet a lot. Like, I imagine the conversational French and Spanish classes need to meet a lot of times in order to get people up and running. But something like a felting class or that upcycled fabric, that might be not that one in particular, but something like that might be a one-time class that just meets.
That's right. We actually give the professors complete flexibility to decide how many times they want to meet, how long their courses should be, and when they want to meet. So you're right, French and Spanish meet multiple times throughout the months, and the needle felting meets only once.
This is the second year, and you have more course offerings this year than last year. So I gather that last year was a great success for Bethel University.
Yes, yes.
So you decided to do this again, and can you explain a little bit about how the funding works? Because as I said, students can go for free, and teachers aren't paid, But if you're doing a class that has supplies, that costs money. And I imagine there's, you know, some facilities needs and some ability to schedule all of this. So how are you getting the funding for this?
Yeah, that's right. We do it by keeping ourselves very nimble and flexible for the most part. There are a few hard costs like printing posters and postcards, the supplies you mentioned, and we cover those primarily through small grants this year, through a small grant with the New England Grassroots Environment Fund and through some generous donations from local businesses and sponsors. Beyond that, everything is donated. Again, we have a great group of volunteers who are putting in many hours to make this happen. And we have great donations from many organizations and businesses in town. The town of Bethel, the public library, the schools have all offered up their spaces for courses to meet throughout the month.
I understand that Bethel University, this sort of pop-up month-long involvement by the community and within the community to teach and learn, sort of sprang out of conversations that were happening after Tropical Storm Irene. And people may remember that Bethel was really very damaged by the storm, damaged in terms of infrastructure, but also the town struggled after the storm to come together and feel like a community. And there was a lot of talk about, how could the town do that better and how could you have a better community feel? So how did those conversations lead to a pop-up university?
It's a long and winding path, but you've got it right. I think after Irene, many people in the community independently started saying, we want to live in a different kind of place where neighbors know each other, where everyone is supportive, where we have a lot of energy and things going on. One thing that sprung up fairly quickly was the revival of the town's Forward Festival, a great community festival. And at that event, a new citizens group called the Bethel Revitalization Initiative put up a poster saying, what do you imagine for Bethel? People walking by wrote dozens of different ideas, and Bethel University was one of them. So in the months after that, we sat down as a group of citizen volunteers and said, let's make one of these happen and put out a few ideas to a vote in the community. And Bethel University was by far the most popular idea.
Oh, really? Everybody liked that right from the start?
Yeah, there was a great deal of energy to make that happen.
So why did this become something that you were passionate about passionate enough about to become one of the organizers of? Because I imagine this takes up a lot of your time.
It does, for a couple of months at least. And my story actually ties back to Irene as well. I had lived in the town for about 5 years before that, but knew very few people. My husband and I worked out of town. We didn't have kids in the school. And when Irene hit, it took us several days to realize how bad the damage was in town. And that was a real wake-up call for me to say, I really ought to know that someone's house was swept downriver a half mile from my house. So I had a really strong personal motivation to start getting to know my neighbors, to get involved in the community, and to help build some of those bonds that would help our community be stronger every day, but also in the case of another disaster.
Do you feel like those bonds are stronger now in Bethel?
I do. I think they're improving a lot. It's not something that can be changed in a year or by one event, but there have been so many small little projects, so many instances of collaboration and trust and community building popping up that it's really an exciting place to be right now.
And Bethel University fits into that? You think that this is community building in addition to being sort of a fun learning experience for
people?
Yeah,
very much so. I think in many cases, people taking classes may not have met before. They may be discovering shared interests. We actually offer a new format called meetup groups this year to help encourage that. If a teacher doesn't want to actually offer a formal course but wants to just have a time to meet up with people with similar interests, they can do that now. And I think it's also really built collaboration between some of the organizations, between the town government and residents. People are using public spaces more. They're getting out. They're learning about local businesses and offerings in the community. And there's just a really palpable sense of energy.
So like any good university, you actually do have a graduation ceremony. What happens for graduates?
The ceremony at the end is part celebration of the event itself and part celebration of the community and everything happening there. So we have a great slideshow of all the courses. People can get a glimpse of what they missed and the courses they didn't take. We hand out diplomas to anyone who participates, including both professors and students. There's food and drink, of course, as any good celebration must have. And this year, we're expecting it to be even bigger. We have a public speaking course, so we're hoping the students in that course may actually get up and deliver talks on what they've been learning throughout the month. We hope we'll have some displays of photography and crafts and things that people have made throughout the semester as well.
And are you hearing from any other towns that want to try to do something like this now?
We have. That was actually a really unexpected benefit. But it, almost immediately last year, we started hearing from several towns that were asking how they could replicate it itself. In the fall, we held an open meeting to talk a little bit about how we ran Bethel University, how we might collaborate and share resources with others. So I know of at least one other town in the state that is seriously planning their own, and probably a handful of others that are thinking about it. We're very happy to share resources, let people know what's worked and what hasn't worked.
And any class you're really excited about this year?
One that sounds the most fun to me is dodgeball. I think that'll be great. We're still trying to get a couple of teams together, I think.
Rebecca Sanborn Stone is one of the organizers of Bethel University. The university is open to everybody during the month of March. You don't have to be a Bethel resident. And we have a link to all of the course offerings at vpr.net. Rebecca, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
My dad had some good advice for me. He said, son, there's a time and place for just about everything. It's called college.
All right. Well, speaking about education, it's been a great day to talk about all things education today, but we're going to move on tomorrow and tackle a new topic. Vermont Republicans made some gains in the State House in November and came close to reclaiming the governor's spot. We'll check in with leaders of the state GOP. We'll get their assessment on how the legislative session is going so far, and we'll hear how they're trying to maintain the momentum they picked up in the fall. You can send your questions or comments about Republican priorities to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon.